It's Friday, and that means it's the 15th edition of the Zogby Report, Real and Unscripted, where I, John Zogby, pollster, and my son, Jeremy Zogby, and pollster, take a look at the news that's dominating our country and the world. And this week, take a special look at what's going on the ground in our country. I'm going to turn it right over to Jer. We have a lot to talk about. How are you doing today?
We do. We definitely have a lot to talk about. And I just want to take it back a little bit down memory lane, back to 2008, when I was actually at the time living in Prague, and I kind of surprised you by coming home for your birthday in early September. And you were giving a talk at the Brookings Institute, and I was able to attend. And at the end, during the Q&A, somebody asked you, they said, so, John, what can we expect from John McCain's speech at the Republican National Convention? So this was during that time where they were having the National Convention. And my brother Ben was present too, and so we were sitting next to each other and we were listening to you. And then later that evening, Ben and I watched the speech, and we just looked at each other in amazement that almost word for word McCain said exactly what you said he was going to say. So not only are you a predictor and a forecaster for elections, but apparently you do that as far as anticipating what a candidate is going to say or what they're going to talk about. So I would like to dedicate a portion of our podcast today to anticipate, project, as we go to November, now that we know, or we think we know, it's going to be Biden versus Trump. What is Biden going to bring to his platform? How is he going to position himself? What is Trump going to bring to his platform and his campaign? How is he going to position himself? What will they battle over? And of course, all of this with the backdrop being the coronavirus, has it changed in any way what they would have otherwise campaigned about?
All right, thanks for the lead-in about John McCain. I'd actually forgotten about that. But, you know, now that you mentioned it about Joe Biden, I think the really intriguing thing is that he's probably going to say much of what he intended to say anyway. However, the coronavirus pretty much enhancing or underlying some of those messages. I think the first message that he will emphasize is empathy, and the fact that regardless of what anyone thinks about how Trump has handled the presidency, he has not been an empathic leader. He doesn't really understand or show the capacity to understand human suffering. That in fact, the only human suffering that he seems to be focused on is himself as a victim before whoever the enemy is, the press, the elites, whomever. I think that Biden has that empathy in his DNA. It is in his story, which is filled with personal tragedy and being a persistent, if I can use one of our neo-tribal names, someone who has overcome adversity. I think that'll be a core message. Secondly, will be the issue of competence. He will underscore the fact that there are moments when you have the right person to handle a crisis. There are moments where you have the wrong person to handle a crisis. This is one of those latter moments. Regardless of what ultimately the federal government and the White House come up with in terms of the coronavirus and its economic fallout, that Donald Trump just is not the right person to be out there. He is erratic. He is self-centered. He is confusing. It's very important for him to contradict the science, That'll be a major theme. And a sub theme while I'm at it is Biden will put himself and the Democrats on the side of science in this campaign. That will be a special appeal, not only to liberals and to moderates, but I think especially to young people who are not only especially worried about now about the COVID-19, but worried about the climate change as well. And then I think finally, and very importantly, Biden will hearken back to the better days of Barack Obama and the fact that Biden is experienced, whereas Trump was not. Biden is a diplomat and a foreign policy expert. Trump is not. There'll be some rationality brought back to the presidency, and that he will constantly remind voters, as will his former boss, President Obama, that at every major decision, Joe Biden was there. And I think that encapsulates what his campaign message is going to be.
Sure. So let's then go to the Trump side, and I'll see if I can, you know, fill in any alternative perspective. But so now what is Trump going to do? What is he, how is he going to combat all of that? What do you anticipate?
Well, this is interesting because I think he the intention was that he would run on the economy when the economy was very good. And of course, the economy is very bad right now and getting worse. And hard to see light at the end of the tunnel economically anyway. So I think what Trump will do, first of all, is say, hey, look, this was a sucker punch. This came out of left field, and any president would have a very difficult time dealing with this. So don't judge me. I didn't cause this. This was caused upon us. But secondly, he has perhaps the opportunity to pull the rug out from under the Democrats, because in many ways, as we've discussed before, Jer, he has become a combination of Franklin Roosevelt and Andrew Yang, perhaps without the empathy. But he's the big spender. He's the Santa Claus. He's insisting, in fact, that the checks, physical checks that go to people's homes, of course, many of those checks are going to go to people who are not on direct deposit. That's going to mean people over 60 years of age. Are going to have Donald J. Trump's name on them as a reminder that he is Santa Claus. And so that's almost a double dog dare to the Democrats that you're the party of the New Deal, but out New Deal me on this one. I dare you. We're already spending $6 trillion to try to heal the economy and much, much more to come. I think that's probably fundamentally it. I may be missing a couple of points, but I think that's the thrust you're going to hear from him.
Sure. On the Biden front, and as of now, he does have a thorn in his side from within the party, and that's none other than AOC, who has come out publicly saying that, look, if you're going to believe in the Me Too movement, and you're going to believe women who come forth and talk about sexual harassment, sexual abuse, sexual assault, then you can't do it when it conveniences you and when it inconveniences you, which I think is a stellar and sound point. So she's obviously talking about the incident that happened years ago on Capitol Hill, and that coming from within the party is, I anticipate, is going to be a major problem, unless she decides, look, I don't want to be that one person who, you know, like we were talking about in previous episodes about, you know, Bernie, did he want to crash the party like a Ralph Nader? As of now, it looks like AOC doesn't care. She's standing by her principle. So that's going to be a big problem that I don't even know if it continues. I don't even know if Trump has to jump on that. I would think that Trump would jump on that because, you know, he does not hold back with, you know, throwing punches, especially where there are weak points. On empathy, I think you're absolutely correct that Biden does have that ability to point to understanding suffering and pain because of his personal losses, and he can show that he is the empathic candidate. However, and by no means is this in support of Trump, I should probably just say that I'm registered as an independent and never voted for Trump and will not vote for Trump. I don't agree with him, but I do have to say, in this corner, or on this issue, he does appear stronger. That sounds crazy, or it sounds funny, because he does not come off as empathic, but all along he has been the one saying that he thinks the economy should not shut down. And one could argue rightfully so, given that, as you have statistics and studies and data show, every percent of an increase in unemployment leads to thousands of suicides. It leads to an increase in crime. So governors who have shut down the economy, and I understand there is a rock and a hard place, there is the alternative perspective that dealing with an increase in suicide and deaths of despair from being stuck inside and isolated, well, ultimately, they are responsible for that. So, I mean, Trump does have that in his sleeve. I would also, you know, tie that into the fact that he's going to say, look, you know, if the economy continues to go in a downward spiral, all along, he's been the one who has said he would like to open up the economy. The question is, and he kind of gave us an indication from his a delivery of his speech last night, that first suggesting governors can open up as soon as May 1st. I do have a suspicion that that could lead to, and he's indicated this in the previous week as well, I do have the ultimate say. I do have the authority on this. If he wants to issue a mass reopening, he has that up his sleeve. He can point and say, I did my best to save the economy. I did my best to get the economy back on track.
All right. So just to comment on a few things that you said, I think your point about Biden and the alleged incident of sexual harassment or assault, even by his former aide, Tara Reid, has some significance and will not continue to be buried, lest the media and liberals and the Democratic Party itself be charged with hypocrisy. So what AOC is doing, I think, is appropriate. We saw that our senator here in New York State, Kirsten Gillibrand, led the charge against the senator and former comedian from Minnesota, who was kind of forced to resign because of alleged incidents, got her in a lot of trouble with liberal women, you know, almost the point, you know, that when their guys do it, it's evil. When our guys do it, well, you know, but they're good on the issues. That is that's a red flag for Democrats and for liberals. But it isn't an alleged incident. It's a he said, she said. I think we're going to have to see is more reporting on this from mainstream media. And then also, does anyone else come out with a story that has, you know, some kind of evidence to it? But I think you're right. It's not going to go away. And it could be a real problem. The good fortune that Biden has at this point is that there's no possible high moral ground that could come from Donald Trump and from the Republican side on this. Donald Trump famously touting himself as in that kind of negative light. The second thing regarding opening up the economy, this is, as you point out, this is a wedge issue. You can see both sides. You can certainly see the side of science and the sense that, look, we can't go on or move ahead without, you know, continuing the health, more healthy behavior that we're trying to do, the social distancing, the testing, and so on. On the other hand, real people are getting really hurt. And that's a tragedy. So we're seeing it in the streets of Detroit, and we're seeing it in the streets of other cities as well. And the the forces who are leading these protests against Democratic governors who are taking a hard line, you know, are none other than, you know, blue collar workers and supporters of Donald Trump and others, but those who are really being hurt and those who are ultimately going to be the swing voters. And so that raises a very significant question. Who does Joe Biden choose as a running mate? Real pressure to choose an African-American and a woman. Of course, he has promised that. An African-American woman who can consolidate many of those younger African-American voters who didn't vote in 2016. Or does he choose someone you know, like Gretchen Whitmer, who is the governor of Michigan, very popular governor, who's being demonstrated against, but someone who could potentially turn a Midwestern state over to the Democrats, one particularly that was lost in 2016. So this gets very complicated.
It's fascinating because, and I'm going to weave this all together, because, by the way, the example that you brought up about Senator Gillibrand, which I had forgotten, and that was the Al Franken case, I believe.
That's right. I had a senior moment. Yeah.
No. I was just remembering it, and so that's right. That did backfire on her. So the question becomes: is this a generational thing within the Democratic Party? So that if AOC maintains her position, maybe she'll alienate those who are, you know, let's say in their 40s and 50s and 60s. But the key question is, will she alienate the Gen Z and the millennials who, yeah, I think everyone would agree, that's her base. And given that that's her base, they're the ones who tend to be the most passionate about the Me Too movement, rightfully so. So It does get very complicated, because then what is Biden to do? Is Biden to choose the Gretchen Whitmer, or is it in his advantage to go with Kamala Harris? Because if AOC maintains her criticism of Biden, maybe the way to win Gen Z and millennials over is to say, well, I have a female candidate who is a minority, and we know that Gen Z and millennials, who are the most passionate in terms of their support for diversity, maybe that could sway them. So, I mean, just a lot of possibilities here. Nothing set in stone, but just trying to analyze the complicated landscape.
Boy, and I can tell you, as you know, I get a lot of calls from foreign press, really from all over the world. And that right now, after, of course, the coronavirus and its impact, the number one question is that they're asking is, who will be the running mate? So it's always an important decision by a presidential nominee, and one that is usually a signal about which way they're going with the campaign, as well as their capacity to choose someone who could be, you know, like Truman or Johnson, you know, within a matter of minutes, the new president of the United States. But there's a lot of focus on this one in particular. This will define, at least in the first moment, what kind of candidate and nominee Joe Biden will be.
Is there anything else that you're looking at beyond politics and beyond the coronavirus? Often is the case where the news becomes so dominated by one or two stories that there's a huge undercurrent going on. And I would ask, from your perspective, what may be the undercovered story of the day?
I think it's looking to the horizon. We're in the eye of the storm right now, and it's hard to look beyond the storm and the immediate impact. But ultimately, who are we going to be as humans, let alone as Americans? You know, what behaviors are going to change? Are we going to tone down and see the fellow humanity more in each other, meaning that we're less likely to define the person next to us or the person whose ideas are different or who looks different from us as the other? Or are we going to see, hey, look, we're all in this this battleship together? What kind of behaviors are we going to change? Are we going to hug? Are we going to continue to socially distance? Are we never going to shake hands? Are we going to bow? Are we going to cross our hands over our heart and give a little bow to say hello? Those are very significant sorts of things. Are we going to continue to be neighborly? You know, we've, Mom and I have lived in this development now for 20 years, and so nice that some of the younger people have said, oh, is there anything you can need, that you need, anything we can do for you? Those are acts of kindness. Are those going to continue? A lot of behavioral changes. Are kids really going to sit in a classroom? Are they really going to sit in a classroom with 35 other kids? Or is social distancing going to rule? What are things going to be like in the workplace? Are we going to stay home? Or are we going to go back to work? If we go back to work, are we going to usher in whole new structures? I have potential answers for those, but you and I, of course, are going to be studying these and seeing what the American people think just over the next week or so. But I think those are the stories that we need to be, and discussions that we need to be having right now. There have been a lot of changes already, and this coronavirus is clearly accelerating those changes.
Sure, I can see both ways, and of course there is always the likelihood that it could be both, that there will be a culture, a newly shaped culture of people who will demand more work from home. I think we're already seeing that. I did see a survey. I don't remember who conducted the survey, but anyone who's interested, just Google, you know, or search anything regarding recent surveys and work from home. But I do remember that it was a vast majority of those who were surveyed said they want to continue working from home. Mm-hmm. So there is that. But at the same time, given within our DNA, being social animals, and this is deeply embedded not only in our DNA but in our conscience, way back in time, that there's going to be that urge, and I don't know that the digital platforms would be able to satisfy that. So while there are those who will remain fearful, there are those who I can easily see overcome the fear. I guess one of the other, and shifting gears here, one of the potential undercurrents of stories going on right now we saw this before the virus broke, and it was mainly on the right, the political right. You know, you can go back, whether it was years ago and the Clive and Bundy stories, or most recently in Virginia, the March on Capitol, in you know, those who were protesting in favor of the Second Amendment, concerned about what laws that the state of Virginia were going to pass. And there was this whole talk of the sanctuary areas, sanctuary counties that were pro Second Amendment. And West Virginia reached out and they said, you know, for you Virginia residents, for you counties who are worried that an executive order from the governor could come out with some pretty sweeping legislation that would, you know, basically deter your Second Amendment, right? You can come with us. And so you saw a resurgence in the idea of secession. And this is, you know, this isn't something that has, this has always been with us in terms of American history. It's deeply embedded in the American psyche. But it's interesting that now, after post coronavirus, now you see it on the left. And mm-hmm. so states' rights is and again, that's not to say that the left hasn't done that. There's a rich history of liberal state right calling for it and practicing it. It's on both sides.
It's being played out right at this moment. Right at this very moment, it's being played out, where the president announced that he has the supreme authority to reopen the economy. It's his decision. And you have leading Democratic governors saying it is not your decision, it's our decision. And then you're having the president come back and say, you know what? It's your decision. Yeah, you do it. And the Democrats are saying, yeah, but you fund it for us. And so it is, you know, a different twist on the same argument over states' rights and the 10th Amendment.
What I'm getting at is, and exactly, the you know, Governor Cuomo is probably the most well-known who has been fighting with Trump over. No, I'm going to say when it's ready for my state to reopen its economy and for people to go back to work. I can see a situation where both sides of the aisle, and both at the state level and the county level, and maybe even the town and the village level, will start practicing what they believe as their political right to govern their jurisdiction as they see fit. And I'm going to certainly track and follow that trend.
And you know what? Let's talk about it next week. Make a note of it, even though we're real and unrehearsed. I think we talked about a lot today. As always, a good conversation with my son. And I want to thank Ryan Miller, who is our producer and chief technician here, for running this pretty seamlessly for us.
Thank you. And as always, we'll see you next week.